into Washington lobbying and campaign contributions. Congress had passed a major financial deregulation bill in the Graham-Leach-Bliley Act of 1999, and the main question before the crisis was whether there would be additional deregulation, not re-regulation. The three of us learned, as had some of our predecessors, that reform is extremely tough to achieve without a crisis to make the case for it, most vividly with Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. Those two firms owned or guaranteed half the residential mortgages in the United States. We each expressed concern before the crisis that they were seriously undercapitalized and underregulated. Market participants assumed the government that chartered them would rescue them if they ever got in trouble, so the companies felt safe piling up leverage, a real example of moral hazard. Ben worked on reforms to strengthen their oversight and rein in their risk-taking during his stint as chairman of the Council of Economic Advisers in the Bush White House in 2005. But Fannie and Freddie had powerful friends on Capitol Hill, and the reforms went nowhere. Hank revived the dream of reform when he arrived in Washington in 2006 and eventually worked out a bipartisan compromise with Democrat Barney Frank that would limit speculation by Fannie and Freddie while creating a more powerful regulator and tougher regulatory standards. The bill passed the House but stalled in the Senate. Reform would have to wait until the firms were on the brink of collapse. The boom was a daunting time to try to improve the stability of the financial system, in part because the system seemed so healthy. Hank led a Treasury effort to create a reorganization plan for the regulatory system, a plan that would provide a blueprint for reform after the crisis, but when it appeared, it was largely ignored. Ben set up a financial stability unit at the Fed in Washington and presided over tougher supervisory guidance to limit banks' exposure to commercial real estate and other risks. And Tim launched a series of efforts with other U.S. and foreign regulators designed to improve risk management and focus more attention on the risk of a crisis. In 2005, the New York Fed led an effort with other regulators to force Wall Street's top derivatives dealers to upgrade their antiquated back-office infrastructure, modernizing a system where derivatives orders were routinely faxed to unattended machines and trades often remained unconfirmed for months. But while the changes mitigated a potential source of confusion and panic, they did not reduce the overall leverage in the system. The firms were reluctant to reduce their exposure to risky derivatives because they didn't want to lose market share. Recommendations of caution weren't much of a countervailing force against the prevailing mood of optimism. And the Wild West with better plumbing was still the Wild West. Our modest efforts to shift the system toward responsibility mostly amounted to trying to close the barn door long after the horse had escaped. For example, the Fed finally moved to crack down on no-documentation loans and other egregious mortgage abuses after Ben became chairman, but the crisis had already begun by the time the new regulations wound their way through the rulemaking process. Federal regulators also had less scope to rein in irresponsible lending than they would have liked. In 2005, banks and thrifts under federal supervision originated only 20% of all subprime mortgages. And once dubious loans were made and securitized, there was no way for regulators to unmake or unsecuritize them, or to prevent fear about them from spreading throughout the financial system. We should have pushed earlier and harder for reform, but a crackdown on mortgage lending would have required a defeat of American political tradition, not to mention the clout of the American real estate industry. There was a long-standing bipartisan consensus that home ownership was essential to the American dream, and the mortgage boom was widely hailed for extending that dream to more Americans than ever, pushing U.S. home ownership rates to a record 69% at the height of the boom. Subprime lending, in particular, was praised for democratizing credit, benefiting low-income families and particularly minorities who had been redlined out of the dream. There was little support in Washington for cracking down on lackadaisical underwriting that was turning renters into homeowners, even though some of those new buyers were being exploited. In general, a regulatory regime that had evolved along with the financial system in the decades after the Depression might have prevented the simultaneous explosions of financial leverage, short-term funding, shadow banking, and even the opaque mortgage-backed derivatives that circulated panic throughout the system. But the actual U.S. regulatory regime was not capable of defusing those bombs, and the politics of the boom was not conducive to reforming the system. There was no momentum for legislative or regulatory efforts to reduce the risk of a crisis that still seemed remote. And even if policymakers had been clairvoyant about that risk, it's hard to see how consenting adults caught up in a mania could have been persuaded to change their risky but legal behaviors. Missing the spark. In any case, we were not clairvoyant. By the spring of 2007, it was clear the housing boom was over and the subprime mortgage market was tanking. But the job market was still strong, and bank capital levels still seemed strong. We didn't believe the bursting of the bubble would have a major financial or economic impact beyond real estate. The impact on the broader economy and financial markets of the problems in the subprime market seems likely to be contained, Ben testified to Congress in March 2007. Hank also described subprime problems as largely contained that spring. The economy did seem healthy, and growth remained decent for most of the year. Tim gave a speech in Charlotte in March 2007, warning about what we might call the adverse tail or the negative extreme. He suggested that a meltdown in the subprime markets could produce positive feedback dynamics, a vicious cycle where fears about defaults and uncertainty about exposures could lead to fire sales, which could lead to margin calls as collateral backed by mortgages looked shakier and counterparties looked less creditworthy, which could lead to more fire sales. That's exactly what ended up happening. But Tim concluded it wasn't a very likely scenario. As of now, though, there are few signs that the disruptions in this one sector of the credit markets will have a lasting impact on credit markets as a whole. By the summer of 2007, however, that vicious cycle was starting to make an appearance. The subprime mortgage lender Countrywide began running out of cash, and its largest rival went bankrupt. Two hedge funds financed by Bear Stearns, including the Enhanced Leverage Fund, named back when enhanced leverage was something to brag about, collapsed after their mortgage portfolio sputtered. Our assumption that the carnage in subprime would bring some healthy discipline to a chaotic sliver of the credit markets without much broader damage seemed reasonable, given what we knew at the time. But it was too reasonable. Our analyses, focusing on the modest size and scope of subprime, left out the unquantifiable variable of fear. We didn't foresee how the complexity and opacity of mortgage-backed securities would lead creditors and investors to run from anything and anyone associated with mortgages, and not just subprime mortgages. We didn't anticipate how bad news about one segment of the housing market could create what the economist Gary Gorton has dubbed the E. coli effect, where rumors about a few incidents of tainted hamburger frighten consumers into abandoning all meat rather than trying to figure out which meat in which stores in which parts of the country is actually tainted. Subprime was a problem, but if it hadn't triggered a financial panic, it would have been a problem just for subprime borrowers and subprime lenders. More than half the U.S. housing losses would happen after the failures and near failures of September 2008. Without the panic, the relatively isolated problems in subprime really would have been contained. Fear turned those isolated sparks into an inferno. But the psychological roots of the inferno didn't make it less dangerous. Fire prevention had failed. Now, the fate of the system would depend on firefighting. Chapter 2. The First Flames, August 2007 to March 2008. On August 9, 2007, BNP Paribas, France's largest bank, announced a freeze on withdrawals from three funds that held securities backed by U.S. subprime mortgages, blaming the complete evaporation of liquidity in the markets for those securities. We knew enough about crises to know that this felt like a crisis, although we had no idea it would metastasize into the worst crisis in generations. What made the news so unnerving was not merely that securities backed by subprime mortgages were losing value, but that BNP Paribas said it had no idea how to assign them any value because no one was buying them, regardless of their quality. That kind of inchoate fear and uncertainty is what panics are made of. Banks were hoarding cash. The rates they were charging each other to borrow were spiking, and skittish investors were pulling money out of other funds to make sure their cash didn't get frozen as well. In the early phase of any crisis, policymakers have to calibrate how forcefully to respond to a situation they don't yet entirely understand. Governments that routinely ride to the rescue at the first hint of trouble can create real moral hazard, encouraging reckless speculation, propping up non-viable zombie banks, and setting up the financial system to fall from a higher cliff in the future. But underreacting can be even costlier and more damaging than overreacting. Ben's academic research had shown how inaction by timid central bankers made the Great Depression great. Tim had seen, while fighting financial crises in Latin America and Asia, how government delay and half-measures can accelerate panics. Unfortunately, crises don't announce themselves as either idiosyncratic brush fires that will burn themselves out or systemic nightmares with the potential to burn down the core of the financial system. Policymakers need to figure it out as they go along. The early stages of a financial crisis are not the memorable stages. Today, Americans remember the government interventions to rescue Bear Stearns, Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, AIG, and ultimately the entire financial system. But in the first phase of our firefighting, we quietly said no to the firms that asked for help. Initially, the Federal Reserve responded with traditional and then less traditional central bank lending to try to restore liquidity to the system. The more dramatic escalations would come later, after the fire started burning hotter. The stability of the financial system began to erode long before most families could feel the impact of the Great Recession, and even our modest early interventions were criticized as misguided overreactions that would rescue the reckless and ratchet up moral hazard. The three of us would work together as a team throughout the crisis, talking to one another every day, usually multiple times. Since the initial problem was a shortage of liquidity, and because at the time the Treasury had very limited financial authority, almost all the early action had to come from the Fed. The Badgett Playbook. In normal times, the main role of a central bank is to lower or raise interest rates, giving the economy a boost to promote growth or hitting the brakes to avoid inflation. But when confidence erodes and credit markets seize up, central banks can also be the lender of last resort, providing liquidity to solvent firms when private lenders won't. The Federal Reserve's lender of last resort function, known as the discount window, offers emergency liquidity to any commercial bank facing a cash crunch. Access to the discount window is intended to allow banks to meet withdrawals by private creditors without having to dump their assets in a destabilizing fire sale. Along with deposit insurance, as well as the FDIC's tools for managing the failure of an insolvent depository institution in an orderly fashion, the federal government had fairly strong protections for the traditional banking system. Unfortunately, the traditional banking system no longer dominated American finance, and it wasn't the epicenter of the problems in American finance. But in the early moments of the crisis, the discount window was the natural place to start. The British journalist Walter Badgett wrote Lombard Street, the Bible of Central Banking, in 1873, and it's still a key part of the crisis response playbook. Badgett recognized that the only way to stop a run is to show the world there's no need to run, to make credit easily available to solvent firms until the panic subsides. Lend freely, boldly, and so that the public may feel you mean to go on lending. The loans should be expensive enough that they'll remain attractive only as long as the crisis lasts. Badgett advised a penalty rate, and they should be secured by solid collateral to protect the central bank in case of default. But the goal should be to make public money available when private money isn't, to push back against panic and stabilize credit. Ben's research had shown how clogged credit channels can devastate an economy, and how the Fed's reluctance to provide liquidity in the 1930s had helped create the Great Depression. The BNP Paribas news created a classic liquidity crunch. Money fled to safer assets as uneasy creditors got pickier about collateral and shortened the terms of loans. The European Central Bank promptly injected $130 billion into frozen credit markets by buying securities on the open market. The Fed poured in a further $62 billion by buying treasuries and issued a statement encouraging banks to borrow from the discount window. Even those textbook initial steps were criticized as too much too soon. Bank of England Governor Mervyn King called out the ECB and the Fed for overreacting to blips in the markets. A month later, the Bank of England would provide similar liquidity after his country's first bank run in 150 years. Inside the Fed, several Federal Open Market Committee, FOMC, members wanted to attach harsh conditions to discount window loans to avoid moral hazard. But Ben and Tim didn't want to add to the stigma the banks already associated with Fed loans. We didn't want banks to stay away from the discount window. We wanted them to take the Fed's money and lend it out. The general infusion of liquidity helped bring some calm to the markets, but even without onerous conditions, the bank's come-and-get-it message did not attract banks to the discount window. The loans are supposed to be confidential, but banks were afraid they'd look weak and desperate if markets got wind that they had paid a penalty rate. That's the essence of the stigma problem, which makes institutions reluctant to take government help, even when that help is essential to the stability of the broader system. The Fed tried to make discount window borrowing more attractive by reducing the penalty rate and extending the length of time for which banks could borrow. The Fed had never lost a dollar on a discount window loan, so this felt like an extremely modest escalation. But many inflation hawks and other skeptics inside as well as outside the Fed thought the central bank should let the market adjust on its own rather than interfere with a deleveraging process they saw as healthy and necessary. I realize the urge to act, to do something, or at least to be seen doing something, can be irresistible, said Jeffrey Lacker, the president of the Richmond Fed. But I think that we need to avoid the urge to play Mr. Fix-It. But the Fed exists to act when credit markets freeze. Economies wither when people can't get home loans, car loans, student loans, or business loans. The hawks believed inflation was a more serious danger and kept believing that even as the crisis heated up. From Ben's perspective, though, the Fed's obsession with inflation and moral hazard during a credit crunch had already created one depression. He didn't intend to let it create another. These debates were an early indicator of the messy politics of financial crises. French President Nicolas Sarkozy advised Hank to find a convenient villain to deflect the inevitable public backlash. He suggested scapegoating the ratings agencies that had slapped AAA ratings on shoddy securities. "You need a simple story, and I know you won't want to blame the bankers," Sarkozy teased him. "But we didn't think our job was assigning blame for the crisis. We just wanted to fix it." The Badgett prescription was the necessary response to a liquidity crunch. We hoped it would help to calm market fears and stabilize the situation without artificially sustaining the financial boom. We didn't intend to provide any more government support for the financial system than was necessary to protect the overall economy. Capitalism depends on creative destruction. Someone builds a better mousetrap, so incumbent mousetrap makers must adapt or die. Automakers wipe out buggy whip manufacturers, then the market determines which automakers survive. The same principles normally apply to financial firms. The strong, nimble, and reliable thrive, while the imprudent and mismanaged get devoured. Failure is usually a healthy phenomenon, instilling discipline in survivors. Early in a crisis, the default assumption should be that private firms face the consequences of their mistakes, even though the firms often clamor for help, and even though policymakers are often pressured to take action to prove they get it. Not all bubbles, or even all crashes, end in catastrophe. It's fine to let a financial fire burn for a while, as long as the damage is containable. It can clear out underbrush and improve the resilience of the forest. Some financial losses are inevitable after an asset bubble, and it's counterproductive to try to prevent all deleveraging or sustain the unsustainable. But severe financial panics are not usually self-correcting, and fires can burn out of control when fear and uncertainty gain too much momentum. When policymakers are too slow to act, because they don't think the dangers are that great, because they're too concerned about avoiding moral hazard, or because they're overly focused on the political fallout, panic can consume the prudent and strong as well as the reckless and weak, innocent bystanders as well as over-leveraged speculators. And panic is contagious. Just as Mexico's debt problems in the 1990s stoked fears about bonds issued by other emerging Latin American economies, the so-called tequila effect, defaults in subprime in 2007 raised suspicions about somewhat safer Alt-A mortgages and even prime mortgages made to the strongest borrowers. There's a fuzzy and hard-to-discern line between a healthy adjustment that inflicts pain on the irresponsible and a panic that imposes indiscriminate damage throughout the system. Systemic crises are not the time for free market absolutism or moral hazard purism, because of the serious risks they pose to lending, jobs, and incomes, and because systemic crises rarely end without governments substituting sovereign credit for private credit, putting some public money at risk and, as a consequence, creating some moral hazard. It's messy, it's distasteful, but it's preferable to a financial implosion that sends the broader economy into a tailspin. There will always be investor pressure on central banks to do more to boost markets, and there will always be political pressure on central banks to do less, to teach speculators a lesson. Ben didn't want to create a Bernanke put by sending a message of unlimited central bank support for troubled markets, but he definitely didn't want financial disruptions to choke off credit and reprise the 1930s. The challenge was figuring out how much support the financial system truly needed, as opposed to how much it wanted. Policymakers can't trust everything they hear from market participants. Even the most credible tend to talk their book, whether consciously or not. But our Bloomberg terminals didn't have all the information necessary to understand the growing risks in the market. We were on the phone constantly with our counterparts in other agencies and other countries, and we talked regularly to the executives running financial firms, large and small, in New York and across the country. Sometimes they gave us market color about what their customers and bankers were thinking. Sometimes we just needed to hear how much fear was in their voices. Sometimes they professed confidence, sometimes they pleaded for assistance. Often they didn't know that much about the risks ahead. We had to sort through all the confusion and self-interest and decide what was in the public interest. The first firm to ask for direct help from the Fed was Countrywide Financial, a $200 billion poster child for the excesses that fueled the housing boom. It had originated one of every five U.S. mortgages in 2006, but by the start of the crisis, the cost of insuring its debt against default had soared 800% in a month. CEO Angelo Mozzillo insisted his firm was fine, accusing analysts who warned about its dwindling liquidity of shouting fire in a crowded theater. But as Badgett wrote, bluster rarely restores confidence. Every banker knows that if he has to prove that he is worthy of credit, however good may be his arguments, in fact, his credit is gone. Countrywide was a case study in just about all the vulnerabilities in the system. Over-reliance on lower-quality mortgages, regulatory arbitrage, and especially runnable short-term financing. First, some of its creditors stopped rolling over its commercial paper, forcing it to sell off assets to pay them back. Then, on the night of August 15th, it looked like the Bank of New York Mellon, BONY, Countrywide's clearing bank, would refuse to unwind its $45 billion repo book, that is, take temporary responsibility for Countrywide's maturing obligations while new lenders were being lined up, which would have signaled its unwillingness to guarantee Countrywide's stability. Repos are a form of short-term debt widely used by financial firms. They are not government-guaranteed, but borrowers put up some of their financial assets as collateral. That vote of no confidence would have triggered a much larger fire sale of the securities Countrywide was using as collateral, and probably a run on Countrywide. BONY said it would unwind only if the Fed indemnified it for any intraday losses it suffered from its exposure to Countrywide. But that essentially would have required the Fed to guarantee the entire repo market, since firms in similar quandaries would have expected similar treatment. Meanwhile, Mozilla wanted the Fed to let Countrywide's cash-starved non-bank affiliates borrow from the discount window. But that would have required invoking Section 13(3) of the Federal Reserve Act, which authorizes emergency actions in unusual and exigent circumstances. It hadn't been invoked since the Depression, and Countrywide still had access to an $11.5 billion credit line. Ben and Tim decided not to intervene. It was early in the triage process, and we didn't want to send a message that the government would backstop any big firm in trouble. And the Fed was a lender of last resort. We couldn't justify helping a firm that could still help itself. Countrywide finally agreed late that night to draw down its credit line and upgrade its collateral, so BONY agreed to unwind. Soon, Bank of America would buy Countrywide and transfer its problems to its own balance sheet. Still, the Countrywide drama foreshadowed the problems brewing outside traditional banks and our limited ability to fix them. It was also a troubling illustration of the danger of wholesale funding. In one turbulent week, the spreads between yields on treasuries and asset-backed commercial paper had skyrocketed eightfold, from 35 basis points to 280, or from 0.35 percentage points to 2.80. We had just seen how the $1.2 trillion commercial paper market and the $2.3 trillion repo market could be vulnerable to runs. Beyond Badgett. The Fed's come-and-get-it approach did not end up luring many banks to the discount window early that fall, partly because the stigma of borrowing from the Fed persisted, partly because the turmoil eased. The stock market hit a record high, interbank lending rates stabilized, and Lehman completed its misguided acquisition of the real estate firm Archstone Smith. So far, the crisis had played out like a rerun of 1998, when the giant hedge fund Long-Term Capital Management's demise produced widespread anxiety, but after a modest intervention by the Fed, no widespread damage. But this calm did not last. First, Merrill Lynch announced the biggest write-down of troubled assets in Wall Street history and ousted its CEO. Then, Citigroup broke Merrill's record and ousted its CEO, the one who had said banks needed to keep dancing while the music was playing. The size of the losses was scary, but psychologically, the sense that financial giants had no idea what ugly surprises were hidden in their own balance sheets was scarier. Merrill's write-down was twice as large as it had predicted 3 weeks earlier. Citi's write-down was seven times as large as it had predicted on its last earnings call. Both firms revealed huge new subprime exposures they evidently hadn't noticed before. They looked oblivious and gave the impression that losses were exploding all around them. The sources of the losses were also unsettling. Merrill's came mostly from super senior CDOs, one of the supposedly safer forms of mortgage securities. But they were still mortgage securities, so investors and creditors who had bought them or accepted them as collateral without much analysis began selling them and rejecting them as collateral with just as little analysis. The sudden toxicity of super seniors was a sign that mania was slipping into panic, that markets were simply frightened of the word mortgage. Citi faced similar problems with the $1.2 trillion of structured investment vehicles and other assets it had stashed outside its balance sheet. SIVs, which had sources of funding separate from the sponsoring banks, had been considered safe during the boom. But now that a few SIVs with subprime exposure had failed, shaken investors were fleeing all SIVs, forcing firms like Citi to bring their troubled assets back on balance sheet to avoid a reputational hit. Hank tried to ease the problem by arranging a super SIV, a privately financed investment fund that would buy SIV assets in order to avoid destabilizing fire sales. But the big banks had too many of their own problems to finance it, and without government backing, the effort fizzled. The Fed also forced Citi to start conserving capital by ordering the bank to reduce its dividend. And together we pressured other troubled institutions to raise new capital. Citi raised $20 billion over the next few months, mostly from sovereign wealth funds in the Middle East and Asia. Morgan Stanley and Merrill also brought in foreign investors, who got to watch their new stakes in prestigious Wall Street firms crater almost immediately. The E. coli effect was beginning to manifest itself as investors and creditors began to shun entire classes of financial products, whether they were contaminated with subprime or not, which depressed their prices and made them even more toxic. It was as if avoiding meat caused E. coli to spread. Fear was overwhelming reason, because nobody knew when bad news would cause the next paroxysm of fire sales. It felt rational to assume the worst. The troubled securities would all be worth something someday. Not all mortgages would default, and the ones that did would recoup some of their value in foreclosure sales. But at a moment when nobody wanted the securities, their prices were dropping without regard to their underlying quality. This was starting to look like a problem the traditional Bagehot playbook could not solve. The Fed's conventional tools, which mostly consisted of loans against collateral to U.S. commercial banks, were proving ineffective in unclogging important parts of the credit system. The few banks that dared to visit the discount window weren't lending to other financial institutions or anyone else, and many of the institutions in trouble were not commercial banks. In December, the Fed decided to launch two novel efforts to boost liquidity, taking a tentative step beyond basic Bagehot into uncharted waters. The first was the Term Auction Facility, TAF, a program designed to overcome the stigma of the discount window by not only lengthening the terms of the loans, but auctioning them to eligible banks, rather than lending at a fixed rate. Borrowers would pay a market rate determined by auction, not a penalty rate, so they wouldn't seem so desperate if word of their loans leaked. Within a year, the Fed would be lending five times as much through the TAF as the discount window. The second innovation was swap lines that the Fed established with the ECB and other foreign central banks, so they in turn could on-lend dollars to private banks in their own countries. They were called swaps because the Fed got foreign currency in exchange for its dollars, as well as guarantees of repayment by the foreign central banks, which are government institutions. Since the dollar is effectively the global currency, making dollars available to foreign central banks was an important step toward calming global markets. A year later, the Fed would have more than $500 billion in swaps outstanding, enshrining it as the lender of last resort to the world. The auction loans and swaps did help ease the liquidity crunch in the U.S. financial system, but the underlying conditions were getting worse, and the breakdown of the credit engine was starting to damage the broader economy, worsening the stresses created by the unwinding of the housing bubble. Hank warned the White House in December that the economy was hitting a wall. The official arbiters of the business cycle at the National Bureau of Economic Research would later determine that a recession started that month. The feedback loop of fear and fire sales within Wall Street was contributing to a feedback loop of credit contractions and business contractions between Wall Street and Main Street. Worsening financial conditions were creating worse economic conditions, which in turn were accelerating the subprime meltdown and the financial panic. Ultimately, we wouldn't be able to stabilize the financial system without stabilizing the economy, and vice versa. To put out the fire, we'd have to do both. In 2007, the Fed provided a little monetary stimulus to the economy by cutting short-term interest rates from 5.25% to 4.25%, but only a little. Ben had led the Fed with a deferential consensus-based approach, trying to get the institution to speak with one voice. But the Fed was falling behind the curve of the crisis, and in 2008, Ben pushed monetary stimulus more aggressively, overriding the objections of the FOMC's inflation hawks. The Fed cut rates to 2.25% by March, trying to provide fuel for the sputtering economy. The Fed would cut rates faster than any other central bank during the crisis, and in retrospect, it probably should have cut them even faster. In a crisis, however, monetary policy can only do so much, especially when the banking system and the public are already over-leveraged and panic conditions are constraining credit. Meanwhile, Hank led a White House push for a jolt of Keynesian fiscal stimulus in January 2008, building support for a package of temporary tax cuts that would help offset the contraction in private demand. He negotiated a bipartisan deal with House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and House Minority Leader John Boehner that consisted of $150 billion in tax cuts with no new spending, as President Bush had proposed. The compromise directed most of the tax cuts to working families, including tax credits for low-income families that don't pay income taxes but do pay other federal taxes, in the way Democrats wanted. The deal sailed through Congress, Bush signed it in mid-February, and the first checks would go out in April. It was a modest response to a slowdown, only 1% of GDP, but it was among the swiftest responses Congress ever approved. It also proved the legislative process could still function, while giving Hank a chance to forge relationships on Capitol Hill that would come in handy later. Still, the fire kept advancing. Among those feeling the heat were the so-called monoline insurers, which had expanded their traditional business of insuring municipal bonds to guaranteeing, for a fee, subprime mortgage securities and CDOs. Losses to monolines led investors to begin doubting the other securities they insured, including municipal bonds. The Fed faced pressure to help all kinds of companies with exposures to mortgages. Ben even personally heard out the head of Thornburg Mortgage, Larry Goldstone, who wanted the Fed to invoke its 13(3) powers to provide an emergency loan after his repo lenders rejected his collateral. The Fed turned down these requests, but Ben and Tim were actively exploring new ways to ease the pressures on the rest of the system, steps that would go beyond lending to banks. In March 2008, the Fed unveiled the Term Securities Lending Facility, an innovative new program that would finally extend liquidity to non-banks, allowing non-bank firms, including the five major investment banks, the ability to swap less liquid for more liquid collateral. The TSLF required the Fed to invoke its Section 13(3) emergency lending powers for the first time since 1936, but Ben told his board it was vital to address the cash crunch in the shadow banking system. This is unusual, but so are market conditions. The Fed approved the program on March 10th, but it wouldn't be ready for 2.5 weeks. By then, market conditions would be much more unusual. Chapter 3. The Fire Spreads, March 2008 to September 2008. Hank reviewed a draft of an economic speech President Bush planned to deliver in mid-March, and he liked it. He thought it would help reassure the nation of the administration's determination to end the crisis. But he did recommend one fix. Don't say there will be no bailouts. The president was taken aback. "We're not going to do a bailout, are we?" he asked. Hank didn't want to, and he hoped there wouldn't be a need to, but the turbulence in the markets was getting worse every day. "Mr. President, the fact is, the whole system is so fragile we don't know what we might have to do if a financial institution is about to go down," Hank said. In fact, a major financial institution was already on the verge. Bear Stearns, an 85-year-old investment bank with $400 billion in assets. Like Countrywide, it now faced a crisis of confidence, in part over its mortgage exposures. Creditors had stopped rolling over its commercial paper, repo lenders were demanding more collateral, and hedge funds were closing their brokerage accounts with the firm. Neither the Fed nor the Treasury oversaw Bear. Its regulator was the SEC, an enforcement agency that focused on investor protections, not safety and soundness. But Bear was so inextricably enmeshed in the financial system that its failure threatened to tear the system apart, and we couldn't ignore the threat just because it began outside our jurisdiction. The collapse of Bear Stearns on March 14th would mark an inflection point in the crisis, exposing the system to its greatest peril and putting America's emergency arsenal to its sternest test since the Depression. The Fed crossed a Rubicon by intervening to prevent the implosion of a non-bank. The Bear Rescue did help avert the cascade of financial defaults and economic pain that we would later see after the collapse of Lehman Brothers, and it helped buy 6 months of relative calm. But it was not particularly comforting, even at the time. We would not have been able to prevent a chaotic failure if J.P. Morgan Chase hadn't been willing to buy Bear and guarantee the vast majority of its obligations. And we knew that Bear wasn't the only over-leveraged and interconnected non-bank at risk of a run. 7 months into the crisis, the Bear drama was a sobering reality check about the frailty of the system, the limits of our powers, and the potential for catastrophe in the near future. Bear Stearns, Too Interconnected to Fail. Unfettered by the capital requirements and other rules constraining commercial banks, Bear Stearns had been aggressive in using leverage during the boom and enjoyed 5 straight years of record earnings. But by the week of March 10th, a run on Bear was underway, and it was hard to imagine how the run could stop on its own. After all, an investment bank that doesn't have the confidence of its clients or the markets doesn't have much of anything. From the market's perspective, Bear was mostly just a collection of fragile businesses and risky assets. Trading businesses depend on trust, and once people started doubting whether Bear was certain to meet its obligations, they were rushing to take their business elsewhere, which was making Bear even less trustworthy. Bear Stearns was the nation's 17th largest financial institution, the smallest of the 5 standalone investment banks. But it was twice the size of Countrywide and far more intertwined with the financial system, with 5,000 trading counterparties and 750,000 open derivatives contracts. It did business with banks, brokerage houses, hedge funds, pension funds, governments, and corporations, and counterparties were scrambling to reduce their exposures to Bear while trying to deduce who else might be exposed to it. The system had already been weakened by 7 months of slow burn, and it was disturbing to imagine the hysteria Bear could unleash by defaulting on its obligations. Fire sales of its collateral, frantic unwinding of its derivatives trades, a meltdown of the repo market. A likely run on Lehman, the next weakest investment bank. Perhaps even the collapse of the mortgage giants Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. By Thursday night, March 13th, Bear was toast. Its cash reserves had dwindled from $18 billion to $2 billion in 4 days, and it planned to file for bankruptcy in the morning. At first, we didn't think we could prevent a bankruptcy. The FDIC had the power to wind down insolvent banks in an orderly fashion while standing behind their obligations, but the federal government had no orderly resolution regime for non-banks that could avoid the chaos of default. We thought the Fed's response would be limited to injecting more liquidity into the markets to contain the damage from an unavoidable collapse, what Tim called putting foam on the runway, to try to prevent the fire from spreading after Bear crashed and burned. Bagehot's toolkit of central bank lending had limited value in preventing a run on a weak institution, and the government's other emergency authorities just weren't as broad as people assumed. The Treasury couldn't do much without congressional authorization, while the Fed's authority was limited mostly to lending against solid collateral. Neither the Fed nor the Treasury had powers to guarantee obligations, invest capital, or buy illiquid assets to stop a run on a bank. The term Securities Lending Facility, TSLF, was not yet in place, and the Fed didn't have a standing facility to lend to an investment bank like Bear. It did have Section 13(3), so it could fund non-banks in unusual and exigent circumstances, but 13(3) was not a magic wand that could make an insolvent company viable, a ruined brand marketable, or toxic assets valuable. In a panic, it can be difficult to tell whether a troubled firm is truly insolvent. Markets are not always right or rational, and it's always possible that securities nobody wants during a spiral of fear will turn out to be solid once confidence returns. That's when government loans and liquidity can help a fundamentally viable firm make its payments and avoid getting dragged down with the weak. But Bear's decline, so much faster and sharper than the declines of similar firms, suggested its weakness was real and extreme. In any case, the Fed had not seen Bear's books and had no basis for concluding it was a solvent victim of a misguided run. The SEC, which did have access to Bear's books, did not seem to believe that either. Based on what we knew, we did not believe a loan against the eroding value of Bear's assets and businesses would succeed in saving the firm. By lending into the accelerating run, we feared that the Fed would succeed only in financing the exits of the few short-term creditors that hadn't already exited, without preventing Bear's ultimate collapse and the chaos that would entail. In the pre-dawn hours of March 14th, the New York Fed staff came up with a stopgap plan to invoke 13(3) and get Bear to the weekend alive. A Fed loan to its clearing bank, J.P. Morgan Chase, which would pass the money on to Bear, which would secure the loan with assets that its repo lenders would no longer accept as collateral. Basically, the Fed would be Bear's repo lender for a day. Many of our colleagues were uneasy with this move, which appeared to suggest we could guarantee the obligations of a failing non-bank, but we agreed it would at least give us the weekend to search for an alternative to disaster. "You can take out that line in your speech about no bailouts," Hank quipped when he informed the president. Because we didn't think the Fed could lend enough against Bear's weakened collateral to save the firm as an independent entity, we still needed to find a buyer for Bear to prevent it from disintegrating when the markets opened on Monday. J.P. Morgan quickly emerged as the only potential savior with the credibility to stand behind Bear's trades, and CEO Jamie Dimon insisted he'd do a deal only if the Fed took on some of the risk of Bear's mortgage assets. So, on Sunday night, the Federal Reserve invoked 13(3) again for another creative interpretation of the Fed's power to lend against collateral. J.P. Morgan agreed to buy Bear for $2 a share, an offer Dimon later increased to $10 to make sure Bear's shareholders didn't scuttle the merger and plunge the system back into chaos. That was vital because J.P. Morgan also agreed to take the risk of guaranteeing Bear's book while waiting for the merger to close, the panic-relieving backstop the Fed didn't have the authority to provide. But the Fed would lend $30 billion to a new entity it dubbed Maiden Lane, which would then buy $30 billion worth of Bear's securities from J.P. Morgan. Under 13(3), the Fed can only make a loan when it is secured to the satisfaction of the Reserve Bank making the loan, a rather hazy standard. A team from the investment firm BlackRock that analyzed the assets J.P. Morgan wanted to leave behind advised us there was a reasonable chance the loan would be repaid without losses within a few years. Ben and Tim decided that if the Treasury indemnified the Fed against any potential losses, the Fed would be satisfied, and Hank readily agreed. But then the Treasury's lawyers told Hank he couldn't indemnify the Fed. We were learning just how little power the Treasury had in a crisis. So Tim asked Hank to write a letter supporting the Fed loan and noting that if it lost money, the Fed would simply contribute fewer profits to the Treasury. Hank called it his "All Money is Green" letter, and while it didn't mean much legally, the Fed routinely remits all of its earnings above its operating costs to the Treasury, it did implicate the Treasury and the executive branch in the Fed's momentous decision. We wanted everyone to know we were in this together. At the same time, the Fed invoked 13(3) again to launch a more aggressive lending program for investment banks called the Primary Dealer Credit Facility, PDCF, which would accept a greater range of collateral, including riskier assets, than the TSLF. We hoped the bear intervention would settle down the markets, but we also knew that Lehman Brothers had problems similar to bears, and that Merrill Lynch, Morgan Stanley, and even Goldman Sachs might need easier access to the emergency safety net. The bear intervention did calm the markets, but it also provided a searing dose of the politics of crisis response. Many politicians and pundits accused us of overreacting to the Darwinian rhythms of capitalism, arguing that the economic impact of an investment bank's failure would be modest, an argument that would be disproved by Lehman's failure 6 months later. Liberals and conservatives alike attacked us for squandering taxpayer dollars to bail out incompetent bankers. Moral hazard purists warned that we were encouraging excessive risk-taking. Republican Senator Jim Bunning of Kentucky denounced us as socialists. Even former Fed Chairman Paul Volcker said the Fed's actions extend to the very edge of its lawful and implied powers, which was accurate. We had been careful not to go over the edge, but did not sound like a compliment. We were realizing that we faced a dual challenge: figuring out the right thing to do and explaining why it was the right thing to do. One thing we struggled to explain about the bear rescue was who exactly got rescued. The intervention did ensure that bears' creditors and counterparties got paid in full, so they would stop running, and so creditors and counterparties of similarly situated firms wouldn't start running. During a crisis, anything that increases uncertainty about repayment of creditors can be a signal to stampede. But Bear itself didn't get bailed out. The firm ceased to exist. Its senior executives lost their jobs and much of their wealth. Its shareholders did receive more than the $0 the firm would have been worth in bankruptcy, but 95% less than the firm was worth at its peak in early 2007. All interventions create some moral hazard, but it was hard to see how Bear's fate would have encouraged other firms to emulate its reckless approach. And of course, the eventual run on Lehman would prove that markets were not confident the government would ride to the rescue again. In any case, we did not squander taxpayer dollars. The bear loan was ultimately repaid and produced a $2.5 billion return for the government. But the point of the loan was not to make money. It was to prevent the messy collapse of a systemically important firm and the inevitable economic damage that would have followed. It's still frightening to think of the chain reaction Bear's failure might have produced at a time when we had not yet stabilized Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, which were propping up what was left of the U.S. mortgage market. Doing nothing was still an option when Countrywide was flailing, but Bear really was too interconnected to fail, and after 7 months in the fire, the financial system really was too fragile to handle its failure. We did not feel triumphant after the Bear rescue. We felt uncomfortable. The episode demonstrated how confidence in heavily leveraged and loosely regulated non-banks with too much short-term funding could disappear in a heartbeat. And Bear wasn't the only financial institution that had borrowed too much and too short with too little oversight, or invested too much in sketchy mortgages and structured credit products that nobody trusted anymore. Hank was so worried about Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac that on the frenetic Sunday of Bear Weekend, he took time out to arrange a call with their CEOs and their regulator, using Bear's example to pressure the firms to raise more capital. Suspicions were also mounting in the markets that Lehman would be next, which can be a self-fulfilling prophecy for a financial firm. Lehman was 75% bigger than Bear, with more real estate exposure, an even larger derivatives book, and $200 billion in repo financing, so in many ways it looked like an even more inviting target for a run. In fact, the entire business model that produced Bear was now under suspicion. After Bear, Hank had to persuade several European finance ministers not to urge their banks to stop dealing with any of the four surviving U.S. investment banks. Now that the Fed was lending to investment banks, it finally gained the power to examine their books. The results were not reassuring. Fed stress tests found that Lehman, Merrill Lynch, Morgan Stanley, and Goldman Sachs were all vulnerable to runs on their wholesale funding, and that Lehman would need $84 billion in additional liquidity to survive a bear-style scenario. We pushed all four firms to reduce their leverage, find longer-term sources of funding, and raise more capital. But investment banks did not look like an alluring investment at the time. We had worked well together in harrowing circumstances to devise a solution for Bear. But we had also gotten lucky. If J.P. Morgan hadn't been willing to guarantee Bear's book and absorb most of Bear's assets, the system might well have imploded that March. Volcker was right that the Fed had pushed the limits of its powers, and the ad hoc rescue had exposed the inadequacy of those powers. The U.S. government still had no way to inject capital into a struggling firm, buy its assets, or guarantee its liabilities, which meant it had no way to stop a full-blown run. If the firm was a non-bank, there wouldn't even be a way to wind it down safely to avoid default. The combination of the Fed's support for J.P. Morgan's acquisition of Bear Stearns and the Fed's new PDCF lending facility for investment banks helped build expectations that we had the will and the means to prevent the failure of the other investment banks. But in reality, the government's capacity to do so was limited. Shortly after Bear, Ben and Hank went to see Barney Frank, the Democratic chairman of the House Financial Services Committee, to explain that Lehman could face a similar situation, so we needed emergency resolution authority to prevent a disorderly failure of an investment bank in case we couldn't find a buyer like J.P. Morgan. Barney explained that the politics would be impossible before the November elections unless we trumpeted our fears about Lehman and persuaded Congress its collapse would be devastating to America. We knew he was right about the politics. Any legislation increasing the authority of crisis managers would be savaged as a bailout bill, and we also knew that alarmist rhetoric could end up rattling the markets and precipitating the failure we were trying to avoid. We would have to make do with limited tools until disaster made our case for more. We felt like we were fighting the crisis with duct tape and baling wire. The markets calmed down a bit after Bear, and we hoped they would stay calm for a while. But as Tim liked to say, hope is not a strategy. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, firing the bazooka. On July 11th, there was a run on an American bank. Not a metaphorical run, like the one on Bear Stearns, but an actual run to an actual building, like the one in It's a Wonderful Life. After the FDIC seized IndyMac Bank, a California thrift formerly affiliated with Countrywide and similarly rash in its approach to real estate, panicked depositors lined up outside and demanded their money back. The FDIC guaranteed deposits up to $100,000, so most of them had nothing to worry about. But the images of panic from the largest U.S. bank failure since the savings and loan crisis of the 1980s made national news. The next week, fearful depositors withdrew more than $1 billion a day from Washington Mutual, a thrift even larger than IndyMac, with similar mortgage exposures. Panic is a communicable disease. IndyMac's failure was a sign that the fire was burning hotter again, but it didn't seem to threaten the core of the system. Our main concerns that week were Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, the government-sponsored mortgage giants that together were more than 50 times the size of IndyMac and more than 4 times the size of Bear. They held or guaranteed more than $5 trillion worth of mortgage debt, and were also the last major source of mortgage financing in the United States, backing 3 of every 4 new home loans. That meant their collapse would halt production of new mortgages and crush the already battered housing market, which would mean more foreclosures on Main Street and more panic about mortgage securities on Wall Street. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac were undeniably systemic, and they were hemorrhaging. There was no standing authority that would enable the government to save Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. Hank would have to persuade Congress to legislate that, forcing our crisis response into the center of the political fray. we would end up essentially nationalizing two of America's most significant firms, another intervention that would have been inconceivable in normal times. Again, our actions were deeply unpopular. But again, we believe they staved off calamitous defaults, and again, they ended